are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, July 23rd, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Anthony Abram Jack on the privileged poor, how elite colleges are failing disadvantaged students. Also on the program today, Kabul seeks clarification on Trump's comment about wiping Afghanistan off the map. The DOJ tells Mueller to limit his testimony tomorrow. New report, 15,000 people dead because 14 states refused to expand Medicaid between 2014 and 2017. Budget deal struck will increase spending by $320 billion. Meanwhile, Trump wants to cut food stamps to kick millions off of food stamps and save not even 1% of the increase in our budget. 2,000 migrants targeted by ICE manhunt. Meanwhile, an 18-year-old Dallas-born citizen held by ICE for nearly 4 weeks. This is a rogue agency. Boris Johnson to become Britain's next prime minister as the sun sets on the empire again.
Again.
EPA website purged of climate change references. And asked to quit by his own staff, John Hickenlooper asked Ivanka Trump for some support. Bill de Blasio floats a Con Ed takeover following New York City blackouts.
Second choice. Second choice.
And Donald Trump is mad at Guatemala because his third safe country deal fell apart. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Just a programming note. We may have to turn down that fan. I don't know. It's pretty hot in here. Actually, two programming notes. Yes, this is No Shave Tuesday. I've just gotten a text in that regard. That's right. Michael's not shaving. And Matt, I don't know if we can cut to Matt. Matt is changing his look dramatically. He came into the office today. Did not recognize him.
He looks like he's in disguise.
He's in disguise.
I am in disguise.
And
it's
a No Shave Tuesday, partly because I woke up late and had to get Saul to the bus. And I hate to say this, but it's also No Shower Tuesday. Yeah.
I have not shaved my legs.
There you go.
Good thing it's not as hot as yesterday.
And Brendan, of course, does not yet need to shave. So, programming note.
Fact check.
Tomorrow.
Shaved yesterday.
Tomorrow, we will start live streaming coverage of the Mueller testimony in front of the Judiciary Committee at 8:30 a.m. Eastern Time.
I'll be in around 9-ish, just to be clear about the...
Whoa, I had no idea you'd make it that early.
Exactly. Michael, don't make promises.
You're
you can't
goddamn
keep.
Right. Exactly. I'm going to say more around 10:15 to be like,
as
geez,
of now,
that was quite
our
a
understanding
testimony.
Is that at testimony will last for 3 hours. Then at 12:30, Mueller will be testifying in front of the Intelligence Committee. I have a feeling we're going to live stream that too, but we're going to make the call tomorrow. There will be no regularly scheduled show. That will be what we will be doing tomorrow. My sense is the only thing that we're going to hear is stuff that is from the report. It's not inconceivable to me that Mueller will sit there, get a question, look up the relevant passage, and read it. But even if that's the case, based upon all the crap that we have to ingest over the course of this administration and just more broadly speaking, people should know what's in the report. And so we're going to force feed it to you. And if you don't like it, then you can go, I don't know, do something else. So that's what we're going to do tomorrow. And we may try to assemble for the podcast essentially clips that would give you a Reader's Digest version. However, that's for your family. You got to watch the whole one with us, and then the podcast is to give to your reluctant family members, because I can't guarantee you we're going to do that. So don't I'm going to skip it. Wait for the cliff notes. I go through this every day with my daughter. So read the book.
You try to force her to read the Mueller report every day.
Don't disappoint the audience.
I would.
You read the Mueller report, young lady.
I get texts now. I try to get her to read a book, and she said to me,
and it was very interesting, and also look up Felix Sater. Look up Felix Sater.
Felix Sater is barely in that report. It's really upsetting.
Felix? My whole theory was
Mila, at the end of last year, she came to me. She had friends over. She's like, have you read Animal Farm? I'm like, yeah, of course. Aren't you supposed to be reading that? Yeah, no, I am. I was just curious if you knew what it was about. And I was like, yeah, I know what it's about.
Trying to do a little Blinkist action with you.
Exactly. And I said, have you read it? And she goes, no, I've read it. And I said, you read it.
I was just trying to unwind the ideas.
I said, where is the book? And she says, oh, it's in that box. And I took the box out. I opened it up. It was dog-eared at page 4. Yeah. And I'm like, you got to read this goddamn book. But I got her reading. No, she wouldn't. But I got her reading a John Green book right now. And she's like now texting me with every page.
I definitely read 1984. I just wanted to discuss the ideas.
Yeah, it's just the ideas. Oh, incidentally, check out our Instagram account. I don't know if we've posted this yet, but we have. If you go to our Instagram, it's out there. I'm not going to tell you what it is, but it is one of the proudest moments I've ever had. Here's a hint. Dave Rubin did a video, and then we did a video about Dave Rubin's video. That's the hint. And you can check our Instagram account. Our Instagram is what? The Majority Report on Instagram. So the Democratic House passed a minimum wage bill. Was it last week? Was it 2 days ago? I can't remember. I think it was the end of last week. And raised it to $15 an hour. Now there are calls from Rashida Tlaib to raise it to $20 an hour. The politics around this are fascinating only because we have seen the Democrats pass 50 some odd bills, maybe close to 60 now. They're not all incredibly substantive, but many of them are extremely significant bills. They're not going to be implemented because they're all die in the Senate, but they're important markers to put down where the party stands. Like, what is the baseline for this party going forward? And they have gotten no traction with the public whatsoever. Understandable on some level because of the nature of our politics these days. Understandable because they're not going anywhere. They're just baselines. They're sort of internal baseball. But the $15 minimum wage, in part because it was such a major plank of the last campaign. You remember, this was Bernie Sanders' plank that was controversial at the time. We are now 3 years out. And just like Governor Nixon has radically changed the dynamics of New York state politics without ever having taken the oath of office because of what she forced Andrew Cuomo to do and the light that she shone on the dynamic with the IDW, a wayward group of Democrats who were caucusing, IDC, who were caucusing with the Republicans, IDW, whatever.
That's an idea. We don't want Medicare for All is maybe a good theory.
Bernie Sanders, in his running for president, has now was able to get the Democratic Party to accept and vote on in favor of a $15 minimum wage. And the problem the right has with this is that I don't believe they can get their voters or, frankly, anyone to care about it in the way that their donor base does. And their way that their wealthy, the wealthy element of their party just hates the idea of it. And so it's fascinating to see them attempt to undercut the $15 minimum wage. And we're going to talk more about this minimum wage in the fun half, but this is, it's always fun to watch what Fox and Friends does, because this is the softest version that they're trying to sell to people. And it's pretty hilarious to watch them try and do this.
We were all in high school. We were in college when we had these waiting tables. Yeah. Unless you're at a very fine restaurant, most of those people at the fine restaurants, that is their career. Right. But they make tons of money.
Now, I should also tell you that, look, the dynamic that they experienced, that they were teenagers and had access to these jobs, is not the same dynamic that exists today. Because the 25-year-olds... or the 30-year-olds that now have these jobs were working in manufacturing or were working higher paid jobs. So first of all, teenagers are less likely than they were when these folks were teenagers to have minimum wage jobs at restaurants. And nevertheless, a vast, I don't know what the numbers were in New York, something like 50% of the people working at fast food restaurants had families.
Yeah, like who works at the restaurants when the teenagers are in school or in bed?
Restaurants, that is their career. Right. But they make tons of money. If you're working at a McDonald's or a small little restaurant where you're making tips, you're right. If you're nice to the people, you make a lot of money.
Absolutely.
So what do you
other restaurants can hear about you when they want
pause it. Now, I don't know if things have changed. I want to go backwards because I want to get Kilmeade's comment, too. But, you know, it doesn't matter how nice you are at a McDonald's. You're not going to get a dollar's worth of a tip.
Oh, you don't tip at McDonald's?
I tip, yes. I leave it outside on the speaker on the drive-thru. Or I leave it on my table.
Yeah, exactly.
When I get up.
Just a 10?
Yeah, I leave a 10 on the table.
A crisp 10 for some good nuggets.
Exactly. So
I get escorted out
a
by security.
Little bit suspicious as to whether they were ever teenagers or if they've ever been to a fast food restaurant. But here's Brian Kilmeade expressing a dynamic, having worked, you know, and I was an actor and a comedian. And so I worked in restaurants as a day job. I never experienced the dynamic, and I knew a lot of waiters. I was in that sort of culture for a couple of years. I never heard of the dynamic that Brian Kilmeade is about to describe that apparently happens amongst wait staff.
McDonald's or a small little restaurant where you're making tips, you're right. If you're nice to the people, you make a lot of money.
Absolutely.
So what do you
other restaurants can hear about
correct,
you when they want
correct.
You.
So what do you think?
Are there any talent scouts here today? Yeah. Because I would love to make the lateral move up from the Jade Lounge.
Exactly.
I've been here for a year, and I like the work we're putting in.
The restaurant
table four, I think, is a friend.
Like Cedar traded to Dunkin' Donuts. The Hooky Lau
table,
Lounge
at table
picks
four.
Up
I think that's the brother-in-law of the manager from the Burger King down in Central Square.
make sure you give him really good service, and we'll all be over there.
Central Square Burger King picks up Cedar in shocking trade.
Unbelievable. And so, like, just
we want to option it for two first-round waiter picks in the next quarter, and then
a no-trade clause.
Yeah,
but here's the thing: is that this rhetoric, it works on their base. You know, the wealthy people who like their tax cuts, who are afraid of just like the insanity that's going on. But it's not going to bring out another single voter that they haven't already motivated. For them, it's just going to be the racism. The other stuff is just filler. But I do think that the fact that they're promoting that the Democrats have passed this is actually helpful. And it's the only piece of legislation the Democrats have been able to pass that they've gotten any credit for. So it's a fascinating, I think, self-own, but they need to address it. And they're not doing a great job of it. We will cover more of this in the fun half because there's some interesting fun dynamics that are taking place with them. Also, I want to remind you, I want to correct myself. It's majorityreport.fm is our Instagram account. I don't know who set that one up. I think it was probably me. Did I do it?
You changed my original one, which was just majorityfm.
Well, majorityreport.fm is better than majorityfm. I don't know what it should have been, Majority Report. I don't know what happened. Can we buy that from somebody? I don't know. Folks, whether you're trying to get a sweet deal on something or find the best happy hour in town, generally, good idea to get reviews first. Let's say you're going to hire a wait staff. You want to find out what the reviews they're getting in Yelp.
Yeah, you want to figure out the reviews. You want to read the talent scouting reports.
Well,
I'm sorry.
That's not the case. But when you're looking for software for your business, it shouldn't be any different. You can read thousands of real software reviews. Find the right software for your business at Capterra.com/majority. Now, I don't use it for software adoption because we don't really use that much software. Although I was noodling around, we want to do something with the debates. And I was noodling around at some of their survey software. But inevitably what happens with me is I look at the enormous amount of categories that they have for software business, for softwares for different businesses, and I get sort of enthralled at the idea of all the different businesses I could be in instead of this one and how much fun it would be. They have over 850,000 reviews of products from real software users, more than 700 specific categories of software. You can join millions of people who use Capterra each month to find right tools for their business. So you can find, last time I read from the C's, let's just look at the H's. Heat map software. Hedge fund software. All the people who run hedge funds who listen to the show. Higher education software. Home builder software, which I'm going to be checking out. Home care software. Home inspection software. I've always thought I would like to be a home inspector, you know, pre-buying it, go around. That
definitely
seems like a cool job.
I
could do that. Hotel channel management software,
yep.
HR analytics software. We're running that on you guys. I got some bad news.
For yourself.
HVAC software. Idea management software. Identity management software. Inside sales software. I mean, it's nuts, all the different companies that you could. I had no idea these were even businesses. K-12 software. Kanban tools. I don't even know what that means. Kennel software.
This is the sound of opportunity kicking in.
Exactly. Visit capterra.com/majority for free. It's free to check this out today to find the tools to make an informed software decision for your business or just noodle around and think of all the different jobs you could have. Businesses you could start. Capterra.com/majority. Capterra, that's CAPTERRA.com/majority. Capterra software selection simplified. All right, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, we will be talking about the privileged poor, how elite colleges are failing disadvantaged students with Anthony Abraham Jack. We'll be right back.
Devastating backstroke all the way.
We are back, Sam Seder, on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Junior Fellow at the Harvard Society of Fellows and Assistant Professor of Education at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, Anthony Abraham Jack, the author of The Privileged Poor, How Elite Colleges Are Failing Disadvantaged Students. Anthony, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So let's just start with your experience that led you to write this book. Tell us how you came to write on this specific topic.
Yeah. Well, I'm a first-generation college student myself. And, you know, in applying to college, I was a public school kid all the way throughout growing up. But then I went to Gulliver Prep my senior year of high school because I had a coach at my public school that liked athlete students, not student athletes. And then Amherst called me. They found me at Gulliver. And then something happened my first day of school. I was like, where are the other poor black people? Everyone kept talking about private jets or private islands or sitting on courtside seats watching the Bulls. I'm like, I'm the only poor black person here. But it turned out that half my classmates who were poor like me just happened to also go to prep schools like Andover, Exeter, and Deerfield. And through programs like Prep for Prep or Better Chance and different places. And we just made up the half of the students. And so when I got to graduate school, no one was talking about the experience of poor students who went to private schools before coming to college. And so I wanted to add that conversation. And that's how I came up with the term privileged poor, like lower income students who, although come from economically disadvantaged backgrounds, we went to boarding schools like Andover and St. Paul. So we were educated and socialized right next to the students who were in the top 1%. And no one was talking about that. And no one was talking about what our experiences were in college because they treated us like one big group of students who did not know how to navigate this place.
I mean, it's a fascinating dynamic, and I want to get to sort of like, you know, the application of this dynamic outside of higher education. But you've described this dynamic between the privileged poor and the doubly, you call it the doubly disadvantaged. I mean, just doubly insofar as what? There is, just walk us through that.
Yeah. So doubly disadvantaged are lower income students who enter college from traditionally distressed public high schools. And I say doubly because they're economically disadvantaged, but their real hurdle is the fact that the gross inequality in America is not between a good public and a bad public. It's the publics and the privates. And so the way in which they go to schools that are underfunded, distressed, overcrowded, that's their real stumbling block. It's not their drive or their intellect. It's the structural inequalities in America that keep certain people in secondary positions. So, I mean, imagine the culture shock of going from an inner city school or a school that's very rural but with no resources and going to an Ivy League school. And that was a story. That's what I wanted to capture. It wasn't about individual differences. It was the fact that certain people were exposed to poverty and inequality, not just in their homes, but in their schools, and then made the jump through Herculean effort to get to college. And I wanted to bring that attention, but also to show that colleges are really prepared to educate those who either come for money or who had educational experiences that only money can buy, like studying abroad in high school. That's not something that everybody can do. That's not something that most schools even have on their radar. But that's the kind of experiences that colleges, especially like Harvard, Yale, and Princeton, value in their students that they can cultivate there even more in college.
They're almost looking for people who have been socialized, regardless of where what their economic status is. They want to make sure that their students, and maybe I don't know how conscious of a decision it is, but they're looking for the cues of socialization amongst wealthy people.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, colleges hedge their bets, right? Even as they diversify, and corporations do it too, they hedge their bets. When they try to diversify, they don't go to the vast majority of schools. They go to schools that they know produce students who are similar enough to them that those students are not going to be surprised or experience culture shock. There's a reason why when I did my study, it was the first to show that 50%, one half of the lower income black student and one third of the lower income Latinx students at elite colleges are the alumni of boarding day and preparatory schools. When you think about boarding schools, preparatory schools that cost $50,000, $60,000 a year, you don't think about a poor black or brown person. You think about a wealthy, white, predominantly male student who's probably the second or third or fourth in their family of the same name. Like, that's the kind of image that you get. But the reality is colleges are going to the same schools that they get their top 1% students from to their bottom 10% students as far as being on economic distribution. They're going to those places because they know that after 4 years of navigating Spence, Hockaday, Middlesex, you are as socially prepared for an Amherst, a Williams, a Dartmouth as the people who are paying to go to those schools.
I mean, it's a fascinating dynamic. And I had a good buddy at my school. I went to Connecticut College, which was not terribly dissimilar from Amherst. Small liberal arts school that had a lot of people from prep schools. And I had a buddy who was first in his family from Spanish Harlem. And I just remember the cultural cues that were completely mystifying to him. And I had come from public school, but I had, was not as adrift, I think, as he was in many respects. It took a long time. It was fascinating. It's also fascinating when he would go home, he noticed the change that was imposed upon him by school when he was walking around at home. And so this cultural divide is huge. Just explain to people how it manifests itself, both in terms of the various things that you need to succeed at these schools.
It's built into the very structure. I mean, my favorite example is office hours, right? Who knows what office hours are going into college, right? Professors always say, on the first day of class, when their office hours are, but they never say what they are. And office hours are just a time that faculty members are supposed to be in their office to answer questions or to meet with students. But it means so much more than that, because those are the people who can be your mentors, who can write you letters of recommendation. But students who come from more affluent backgrounds or who have been socialized in these prep schools, they know these terms already. They know what they should do in them. These things are not new. And so there are some students who come in, fluent in this language of what college life. They know what office hours are. They know that fellowship means more than just going to church. It means Beinecke, Rose, and Marshall. They know the hidden curriculum, that unsaid rules and hidden expectations that permeate college. Lower income students who do not go off of these prep schools they experience culture shock because everything that they come to see in college is very different from home. The way you are expected to interact with people, the way in which you are expected to speak in class and make friendships with faculty members, not treat them as authority figures. And all of these things cause, especially in the W disadvantage, this sense of being torn, because you have your friends and family at home that are telling you one thing about how to get ahead, like keep your head down, don't bother people. But then the college is telling you, no, bother us. Come to our office, talk to us. We want to know what's on your mind. We want to get to know you as a full person. And so they feel this internal divide happening between them. And it's like they're applying for a citizenship in this new place that they don't know how to navigate, but they're losing a little bit of home with every day they spend away from it. And so these internal dynamics that come to manifest itself, and it's not about internal, like individual things. This is how poverty works. This is, as I say, the pernicious power of poverty, the way in which it isolates and then separates. And what you actually see on a college campus is the way in which it manifests itself on the individual person.
Folks are socialized for deference, not entitlement. I think you've...
Among the W disadvantage, but the privileged poor and their affluent peers of all races are much more entitled to a faculty member's time, resources, energy. I mean, I had students who told me that they had no qualms, going to a professor, calling a professor on their cell phone when they were away from campus with prearranged office hours. They felt perfectly comfortable being extended the offer, like, oh, call my cell phone because I'm in New York, and they called. That is the kind of comfort and level of ease that they have with working with adults by the time they enter college, and it helps. I mean, you need 8 letters of recommendation to apply for the Rhodes. How many people in this world can say that I have 8 people who can write confidently on my behalf and who know me as a whole person for me to get this promotion or this, you know, this position at work or this fellowship at school? A lot of the double disadvantage know maybe 1-2 faculty members by the time they get to their senior year, and that person may not know them as well as other people.
To what extent is race and culture versus, I mean, I guess, to what extent, I guess, is race also sort of like a double layer on this, right? I mean, because I noticed on one of the reviews of your thing, there was a comment from somebody that was something to the effect of, I went to Harvard from a good suburban high school, graduating first in my class. And then this guy goes on to talk about how he scraped and paid for the tuition, room and board. Spending money was on me. He worked dorm crew. He earned a little money. I was intimidated by my peers who had traveled to Europe and came much better prepared for college. Welcome to the real world. And he goes, he comments on what you had written. We need to make a concerted effort to teach students about each other. What a silly idea, this guy writes. Students can and will naturally learn about each other. What, I mean, to me, this is somebody who is not aware that that he is part of a dominant culture where the cues come more easily. Is that, I mean, to what extent does this, you know, is there a deficit, or I should not, rather not a deficit, but a gulf that exists even despite the acclimation that might come from like a prep school?
Yeah. The thing is, race amplifies class differences. Given the history of exclusion and racism in this country, race amplifies class differences. The fact that a white family that makes $30,000 a year lives in as disadvantaged of a neighborhood as a black family that makes $100,000 a year, that just shows you how, again, race amplifies class differences in America. When you get to a college campus, the road you take is very, very different, even between black middle class and white middle class students. Because even black middle-class students have not had the access to the same kind of resources in their neighborhoods and their schools as their peers from similar backgrounds. So the question of just like this whole bootstrap metaphor that you can just like work your way through or just keep your head down and you're going to work ignores a lot of the history. But that's the nature of America. Like, we ignore history like it's our tradition.
Right.
And so like the way in which we have to understand these processes, but then even as I say that, talking about processes is something that, again, is not talked about over everyone's dinner table because it's like kind of like what's right in front of you. The thing about a perfect example in the way in which like race can amplify these differences, I talk about a program where students get a scholarship ticket to go to events. And that's a good thing, right? Because college can be expensive and not everybody can spend $25 every weekend going to a dance, right? To be social. But the difference is the school gave out the scholarship tickets on one side of the room and everybody who was paying on the other. It looked like reminiscent of Jim Crow South because there literally was a colored corridor policy that was in place, not intentionally, but in application, because the students who were on financial aid were visibly identified as those who had to go to the other side of the room to do so. And you saw literally physically the black and brown bodies along with some white and Asian students on one line, but the other line was almost like its mirror opposite. So understanding how these subtle differences between individuals play out in the everyday experience of the students is something that we must understand, because it's not just that we do the diversity work, that we do the inclusion work, but it's also how we do it.
Because I want to sort of broaden this out even more beyond the university, but within the context of the university, why is this important? I mean, that may sound a little bit remedial, but I think it's important to remind people like the value of this.
Because the thing is, what happens on a college campus, let me think. Educated citizenry is a better citizenry, right? We are better prepared for today's troubles and tomorrow's problems, the more educated we all are, right? The more innovative we can be. Like, diversity, like, innovation, exploration, different ideas is driven by the diverse minds that we have in front of us. I can think of examples of how when you only have, like, a certain group in a room, think about all the facial recognition software when Snapchat used to do the filters where they only picked up light faces, because even, like, people in understanding of tone didn't take into consideration different things. But corporations are better for it too, right? We have better ideas. We become better the more people we have around the table, the more educated citizens. That's just a fact. And we should pay attention to that. And the way in which inequality is completely shaping who gets to go to college, and especially, like, you see that even more, not just who gets to go, but what tier they go into. The fact that students in the top 1% are 77 times more likely to attend an Ivy League institution than those in the bottom 60. Like, we are hurting ourselves. We are curtailing our efforts in science and technology. Think about the gender imbalance in STEM and all these in all these different worlds. We become a better citizenry the more educated we are. But we become even stronger when everyone is educated, not just one race or one particular segment of the income distribution. That's just a fact.
It also raises the interesting idea of some of those 1% actually going to a free public option in each of their states. It would be nice to sort of filter it both ways. What is the talk a little bit about, use this term, hidden curriculum. What is that hidden curriculum?
Yeah, the hidden curriculum, I describe it. It's a term that a sociologist, Jean Anion, came up with. It's the unwritten rules and unset expectations that permeate higher education. But it's not just higher education. It's any institution that we have. I mean, think about, again, I use office hours because of language and understanding that students not only should know what office hours are, but go. But think about corporations, right? At office hours in college become open door policies at work, right? And so the same process can continue. If recommendation letters in college are built upon relationships with faculty in school, just as promotion and selection for certain projects at work are dependent upon relationship with mentors, right? So this hidden curriculum is understanding what are the hidden ways, what are the unsaid ways that this happens? How do you get that mentor? And it's usually some way that everyone takes for granted. Oh, you just go and knock on their door and just ask them questions. Or there's some implicit system of connecting with people or showcasing your skill that many people don't have access to, either because of their gender, racial background, age, or some kind of way that keeps them on the outside.
You know, it also occurs to me that this concept of a hidden curriculum also sort of exists even outside of institutions on some level. Like, I, you know, the just, you know, at one point back in the day, I bought a house, and my ability to sort of navigate that process was a function of, I had a buddy who went to law school, and, you know, my folks had bought a house, and I had another friend who had bought, like, I had resources around me because of just where I was positioned in life. And so I went through this, but I'm literally giving advice on buying a house to a guy who's working at a coffee stand down the street because he has access to no one else on how to do this. And that to me seems like almost like the hidden curriculum of life is that exposure that people have to all sorts of, like, financial dynamics or just, you know, sort of broader dynamics of what I perceive as being an adult. But it's not just being an adult. It's being an adult who has access to people who have done this stuff.
Absolutely. You hit the nail on the head. And in fact, I actually started using this in my teaching. One of my favorite commercials is the loan commercial with Keegan-Michael Key.
Right. The Rocket loan. You know,
I think the Rocket Mortgage one. I love that Rocket Mortgage and Quicken Loans one, because the person says something in such a convoluted way that only those within the industry know, especially the home buying or the woman who's swiping on an entrepreneur. That means he's unemployed. Lifelong walks. That means he doesn't have a car. Like, he's being that translator. Part of the, like, you're absolutely right. There are so many aspects of the hidden curriculum of life, especially as it pertains to finance, that only certain people really have access to it or have a mastery of it. And that kind of control over that knowledge or those resources, the only way you access it is if you know how to play the game. And playing the game, you only know how, one, if you feel comfortable doing so, and two, you have the skills to do so, because it's a two-part thing. It's not just wanting to buy the home. It's like also having the skills to know who you should access about, should I do FHA? Am I a first-time homeowner if I did this? Should I take out a second mortgage immediately for the X, Y, and Z purposes? All of those things. Do I need to have insurance? Like, all of those things, people can serve as gatekeepers to that information. How do you access those gatekeepers, whether within an institution or out of it, is incredibly important.
Right. And you need people in every community who have access, who have experience and access to this type of information so they can spread it to their peers, essentially.
But we know through the forces of the historical legacy of redlining and blockbusting and FHA loans,
yep,
the historical legacy of exclusion prevents that from happening. We know how segregation works in America. It's not just who your neighbor is, but it's also what information that you have. We know that that's the reality. So some communities get no access to these kind of information, let alone the institutions that serve those communities, the elementary, middle, and high schools, and also the colleges that do the recruiting from certain places. Because quite frankly, some colleges have never stepped foot and will never step foot in certain districts because they don't see them as places where they can get students from, or that students can, or vice versa. Students don't believe that they are part of the institution. Think about what Michelle Obama said about Chicago. She felt that Princeton was more of a place for her, despite Chicago, University of Chicago, being in her own backyard. Think about that for a second and understanding how place matters so much in students' understanding of themselves and their mobility.
What can be done, you know, to deal with this? I mean, one of the things that occurred to me is the work that's done by Richard Kahlenberg. Are you familiar with the stuff that he's done?
I mean, I do.
Characterize it for people, because I think it, in some respects, what you've written about reminded me of his approach, which is in part born out of the Supreme Court contracting the ability of higher education institutions to engage in affirmative action, racial-based affirmative action. And he basically proposes various ideas on how to achieve a similar outcome, but a better version of that outcome by doing it based on class.
So the class-based measures are a good step in the right direction, but the fact that it does not take into consider racial inequalities, it falls short. Focus specifically on social class, especially because when you think about like what I said earlier, that a white family that makes one third of what a black family makes lives in as equally of a disadvantaged neighborhood. That's the lasting history of the legacy of racism and exclusion in America. I actually thought that the College Board's Environmental Context Dashboard does a better job at not just looking at how social class inequality affects students, but it puts it in context of their score and takes into consideration. It's more intentional about taking into consideration how place matters in your own performance, especially on a standardized test like that. Taking into consideration both the family, the neighborhood, and the high school context, looking at measures like vacancy, neighborhood disadvantage, and violence, because we know that those things affect score.
So
it gives a more robust understanding of class inequality in America.
So if I understand what you're saying is that there's the test gives essentially a numeric value, let's say, to various challenges that are measurable in the context of a neighborhood, whether it's income and, like you say, vacancies and, you know, other disparities, I guess, and uses that in to create a score. Isn't Kallenberg's work, to my understanding, and I don't want to get too far afield here, but yeah. is that that his proposal was something to the effect of take the top 10% at every school in a city, for instance, so that you are necessarily taking the top 10% of schools that are typically overlooked, where maybe they'll take the top 1% from a school that is supposedly underperforming, but rather you got to take the full 10%. I mean, I guess this was done, if I'm not mistaken, was modeled out in Texas to see what right. kind of student body you would get if you were to do that, and measured it against race-based attempts to diversify, but using class as a surrogate, and found that you would get a similar outcome in terms of race, but you would get more of those doubly disadvantaged kids than you would under a strictly race-based system.
So the place-based measures have gotten mixed results, even in Texas. I mean, there's been a recent study that actually showed that the Texas really did have mixed results, and all depended.
Okay.
The thing is, what I want to say about this is also this: access is not inclusion. The focus on access sometimes hurts any efforts to work to understand what happens when students get to campus.
Right.
I believe that we focus so much on access, who gets in and where, that we forgot to think about in very critical ways what happens when they do. Because colleges serve as mobility springboard for students. How much of a mobility springboard depends on what happens between convocation and commencement. And I'm glad that you mentioned that you went to Conn, because Conn is one school that I think has, after engaging with the research that I put out, has actually made some of the most significant changes to how they work with students on campus.
Yep.
For example, spring break, we haven't talked about like some of the other things, but food insecurity is a major issue that's getting a lot of attention right now. Four senators just introduced the College Hunger Act of 2019 to address food insecurity as a national issue. And it is a national issue because roughly 2 out of every 5 students in college are actually food insecure, not knowing where their next meal is coming from for a certain amount of days out of the week. Conn College actually changed its policy from shutting down during spring break, which it does happen at even the more selective, private, wealthy schools, to actually say, let me take a step back. They didn't only shut down during spring break. They used to charge students a daily rate to stay on campus. They completely reversed that decision. So now they not only provide for students, but they have other social programming to help students navigate that particular time.
This is for kids who don't have the opportunity to go to Bahamas on spring break or whatever it is.
The fact of the matter is that there are some students who don't care about where their friends are going. They're worried about where their next meal is coming from for a week or two. Because students who can't afford to go home or who don't have a home to go to, or for those students who know that hurt and harm are synonymous, think about students in the foster care system. Think about students who, for their gender or their sexual identity, are no longer feel safe at home, or they have to go back into the closet during these periods of time just so they can have a place to sleep over their heads. A roof over the head as they sleep. These are real questions that students are talking about, and these are students at residential colleges.
Right.
What about those students who are at community colleges or those students who are at community colleges where food insecurity is the highest? Again, when we focus so specifically on who gets in and who goes where, we kind of forget about, as we diversify our campuses, how do our old ways of being become new obstacles for our new students? And spring break, because I studied residential colleges, was a major hurdle that even at a school with a multi-billion-dollar endowment, 1 out of every 7 students faced some form of food insecurity because they shut down during break.
So I
chronicled this for the entire nation of colleges that have adopted the most progressive financial aid policies, and only 1 out of 5 kept their schools open during elective breaks and fed students.
How does that level of ignorance, and I don't, you know, I mean, I'm trying to be gentle with that term, but that's, I mean, that is because on one hand there's a would say probably an explicit understanding of like the value of having a diverse student body here, but then they stop thinking about it and don't even understand the implications of we're having a diverse. I mean, like, you know, it's fairly obvious, like, okay, we're going to do an international program, so we're going to have non-English speakers on campus. We better address that. But there's no, there seems to be a total, you're describing what seems to me to be like a total ignorance of the sort of the deficit of experience or the experience gap or the cultural gap, I think is what you call it, of these students that they're bringing in. So there's an awareness that we need to go out and find these students in some way, and we need to create diversity. But then there's a lack of awareness that to the extent that we're bringing people in to diversify our student body, we're not even conscious of how little our structures here reflect that diversity.
You know, I was hoping that it was ignorance, to be honest. But the more I dug, the more I think it's not ignorance, because there are some colleges who literally have on their website, only if you are working on campus can you stay on campus and not pay a fee, or only if you are international students. Many colleges have protected groups, and they began to have a conversation that in my mind came harped upon who's deserving and undeserving of this additional support. Because I did hear feedback and say, well, haven't we given them enough financial aid? Like, why don't they just go home during spring break? I've heard that time and time again. To the point that to engage those people, I don't make an argument about basic needs to them. I have to make an argument about how is this hurting your retention and graduation rates, and how is it hurting you in the rankings?
Right.
Because food insecurity undercuts academic ability and social functioning. So if your students are going hungry, then you need to think about this not as a moral issue or a safety issue, if you are so callous enough to that. Think about this as how is it hurting your bottom line? Right, and so I had to adjust it. But a number of school officials around the country had some pushback against, like, why should we spend this additional money to open during breaks or to open food pantries and food banks or partner with different organizations when haven't these students been given enough? Or, like, how much pampering are we going to do of these entitled kids? But the interesting thing is some schools made provisions for international students,
right,
or students who are working on campus. So it's not a pure ignorance. Schools are not ignorant of the facts. Even the school that I study gave their athletes per diems during breaks. So athletes literally got a dollar amount every single day plus catered breakfast during these breaks, while their peers went to food banks, went to food pantries, ate one meal a day from whatever they can find on campus. One student I engaged with at a conference, she stood up in a room of 200 people and she said, well, Tony, I increased my online dating activity in the week leading up to spring break to secure dates the following week. You know, banking on gender norms of older men paying for the first meal, she treated OkCupid as if it was DoorDash. These are the strategies that students are adopting to literally make ends meet during these shutdowns that their peers at other schools are facing even more frequently. Like, we're putting many of our students in harm's way, even as they strive and bust their butts to achieve the American dream of walking across that stage or just simply receiving that bachelor's degree.
Wow. And has there, how hopeful are you are their progress? I mean, it sounds like you're going around and consulting with schools and sort of helping them on this. Do you have a sense that there's an increased awareness, or at the very least, I mean, I guess awareness is not so much the issue. Have you been able to successfully shame or show them that it's better for their bottom line to have some humanity in this regard?
It's been more of a collaborative effort, and I am very proud of schools like Khan College that are not as rich as Harvard and Yale, but have taken steps to put what money they do have on the table and support their students through different initiatives and the dean like Jefferson Singer. And Smith College has reversed their decision, and a number of Lafayette have reversed it. So it's been a lot of collaborative effort. And I haven't had to just go to look how this is increasing. This how this could increase intention. I am optimistic that colleges will continue to do the right thing on certain issues, not just because it's going to look good, but because it's the right thing to do. I'm optimistic that like Senator Warren and others are taking food insecurity as a major issue, but I hope it doesn't just stop there. I think that this needs to be written into the renewal of the Higher Ed Act and make it as part of something that will be longstanding and help generations of students. And I think colleges, hopefully I can push them to also take a national a voice in this national conversation about why food insecurity and housing security and other forms of inequality should be addressed not only on campus, but at the state, at the local, state, and federal level.
Anthony Abraham, Jack, the book is The Privilege Poor, How Elite Colleges Are Failing Disadvantaged Students. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
All right, folks. I'm glad to hear that about my college. No, Brenda did not tell him to say that. I certainly, I did not. There was, we had a long time coming. There was a takeover of our administration building by a coalition of people who were looking for the college to be more sensitive to the needs to diversify the college and the needs of those students of color who were on campus at the time. But I guess the wheels of change, they move forward. It may be a little bit slow because that was a while ago, but that's encouraging. Folks, you can support this program by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Don't make me play. I played for everybody else. The ad that I found.
Become a member immediately.
Become a member immediately. Found an ad that we played back in the day. I wonder, like, when we produced that. That must have been old Dorsey, who's new again.
New, yeah. Second time new.
Right. Prodigal Dorsey returns. But the ad was, yeah, don't make me do that. Don't make me do it. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Become a member. We say thank you by giving you extra content every day in the fun half of the program. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Check out our AM Quickie. Check out our AM Quickie. It's already in the Majority Report audio feed. Head over there, check it out. And if you have any comments, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Ultimately, it's going to be in its own feed. I'm not sure when that's going to happen. Maybe several weeks, maybe 5 or 6 weeks. I'm not sure when we're going to launch it out for the public at large. But good way to just stay on top of what some of the main stories you're going to want to pay attention to over the course of the day. Also, don't forget, Capterra is the leading free online resource to help you find the best software solution for your business. It's got over 850,000 reviews of products from real software users and more than 700 specific categories of software. I bet you didn't even realize there were over 700 specific categories of business software. There are. I didn't even know there were 700 businesses. I thought it was basically you're either a lawyer or a podcast host, or you own a store, or you're involved with banks.
Okay. What about waitering? We talked about that earlier.
Well, you're involved with a food store.
Food store. All right. Fair enough.
A retail business.
I thought literally in the beginning you were going to say there's talk show hosts and lawyers. That's all I see.
That's it. Those are the two options.
A little myopic, but I like
it. The two genders.
That's it. I just had two.
It's binary.
Anyways, visit Capterra.com/majority for free. It's totally free. And you get to read all of these reviews. It's nuts. And you can make an informed software decision for your business today. That's Capterra, C-A-P-T-E-R-R-A, C-A-P-T-E-R-R-A.com/majority. Capterra, software selection simplified. Today is Tuesday.
Indeed.
And
tonight
will be Tuesday night.
We are talking about the, with little fanfare, Syriza was just totally crushed in Greece's elections a couple of weeks ago. So we're going to be talking about the lessons of Syriza, how that might apply moving forward or not apply for Sanders, Corbyn, and left movements around electoral politics. Then Crystal Ball joins us to talk about how to deal with the media bias against Bernie. What does that actually look like in practice?
She's not in studio, is she?
No, she's not.
She lives in like D.C. or something.
Yeah, I think she's D.C. And then Joshua Kahn returns. Last time he was on, he gave us really great practical lessons on organizing. As an example, he gave us the Simpsons lesson on organizing coalition. So we're going to do more of that and talk about what's happening in Hawaii, and we'll also touch on Puerto Rico.
Plenty of other
stuff.
Guy.
The telescope. Yeah.
Con?
I walked in.
Yes.
And you saw the graphic.
Yeah, that was pretty good.
Exactly that type of stuff. Excited to have him back in studio joining us from the West Coast. And a whole bunch more, including, of course, Iran, the UK. It's a jam-packed, full show. I just want to say really briefly, I'll just mention one. Today, on Field of Burn with Brianna Joy Gray, I'm featured talking about Bernie, Lula, and Brazil, so give that a listen and subscribe.
Folks, this just in, the Senate has voted 90-8 on Tuesday to confirm Mark Esper as the new Secretary of Defense. This guy was, I think it was a Boeing executive.
Was it Raytheon?
Raytheon. He also refused to take a pledge to not work for a defense contractor more than, what is it, like 18 months after he left office or
maybe
something
even
to that
less.
Effect. Yeah.
He
refused to take the pledge. Because, yep. You know what, basically it's like, well, what are you going to do? Not have the defense secretary? That's basically what it came down to. So the corruption has become sort of endemic, right? Like, it's not even like worthwhile pretending you're not going to be corrupt anymore. This is going to be the legacy of this era, folks. You don't get this back. It doesn't. This is the one area where I sort of feel like incremental reform is not possible. You don't get a creeping back of ethics. It's not the way it works. So it's going to take something dramatic to get us back to a place where you have nominees who are basically like, yeah, I'm going to throw some bones to my friends at Raytheon now, and then I'm going to go get paid for it in about 18 to 20 months. Maybe if we're lucky, I'll be out of here in 16 months after Trump gets booted, and I'll go back in. I'm going to make a ton of cash. When that becomes the testimony that you give to get the nomination job, you know we've got a problem. That's basically it. I mean, I'm being a little bit flippant, but not
no.
too.
No, I won't.
Jamie.
This week on the Antifada. So, Andy and Sean recorded an episode with Prank Stallone, a.k.a. Chris James, the guy who prank called Sebastian Gorka.
Was he the guy who was coming on this week?
Yeah, Friday. Want him on Friday?
So, I'll see. Yeah, maybe. I don't know. It could be too close.
Guess we beat you to the punch on that.
I guess
Sorry
so.
About that.
Going to be a little quieter about who we're planning to have a guest on.
I had nothing to do with this episode, so it.
I know Andy and Sean probably have listening devices in this room, but go ahead.
I mean, you might want to sweep the ground for bugs. Yeah,
I do.
So yeah, they talk with him about, you know, the art of the prank and some other stuff. They also talk about bike protests, memories of the 2004 RNC. The continuing Jeffrey Epstein affair and the escalating insanity of the migrant crisis and what we can do to fight against ICE and state violence. Also, dropping tomorrow is an episode that I recorded with Tithi and Chinzia, two authors of Feminism for the 99%, a manifesto. And it's a topic near and dear to my heart, and I hope everybody listens.
Matt.
Coming up this weekend on the Literary Hangover, we're doing James Fenimore Cooper's The Pioneers, which is the first in the Leatherstocking Tales. It's an interesting book because it's James Fenimore Cooper writes about, basically, he fictionalizes his dad's legacy, which is that he founded Cooperstown, New York, basically at a time during the revolution in Europe, so grain and potash commodities were very valuable, so it was easy to settle a land and make it pay. But he thought it was mainly because he was such a great founder and settler. And eventually in late 18 teens, all of his speculations, he was the type of guy who would measure or lease property out to freehold without measuring it first. And that ended up creating problems and made his kids go deeply into debt. And to get out of debt, James Fenimore Cooper started writing books. And that's The Pioneers. So check that out on Saturday.
All right, quick break. Fun half, 646-257-3920 is the number.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 boy, back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Almost as what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back, back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Danerke's song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danerke.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, fuck. Reminder.
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are...
Psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What?
Almost says what?
Hell out of the bank. Hell out of the bank. Hell out of the bank. Hell out of the bank.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black Africans. And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black.
Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle.
Come on!
Fuck them. Fuck em. Fuck em. Fuck em. Fuck em.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday! Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black.
Come on!
What? Come on!
What?
Come on!
Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here!
I am a total
pussy. Pussy, 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 pussy.